From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from Richmond in East Bay.
Terry Hills Pinole.
Dolores at Market Street.
Daly City.
Outer Sunset.
Castro and Church.
Edge of the Mission.
Yorktown. Antioch.
Nopa, San Francisco.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the complexities of bias-based policing.
Frankly, there's going to be racial profiling as long as there are stereotypes about race and crime and there's law enforcement.
We'll also hear about one man's quest to prove his innocence after being convicted of murder.
I feel like y'all tripping. Y'all making a mistake. You know what I'm saying? You really don't know your job if you're trying to accuse me of murder. You're not doing your job.
And remembering the 1906 earthquake.
We all rushed out onto the porch and we all looked at each other aghast. And we said, what is this?
Stay with us for Cross Currents. Law enforcement agencies across the country have policies protecting people of color from being racially profiled. But studies have shown Black and Latino drivers are searched at more than twice the rate of white drivers. Black women are three times as likely as white women to be imprisoned. And according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, one in three African-American men can expect to spend some time in prison. Many people of color have experienced the discrepancy between official policy and reality. But as KALW's Kyungjin Lee reports, it may not be something officers can actually control.
In March 2010, Quizon Malouf was driving his Cadillac XLR to his Castro Valley home. The managing attorney in San Francisco's Public Defender's Felony Unit was stopped at a red light when an Alameda County Sheriff's deputy drove past him, made a U-turn, then turned on his lights.
After I was pulled over, the officer approached my car, and the first thing he said is, "What did you just yell at me?" And I thought, you gotta be joking.
Malouf pulled out his cell phone to record the interaction. He told the deputy that his driver's license was in the trunk, but did not permit the deputy to retrieve it. Backup arrived. They cuffed Malouf and escorted him to the back of a cruiser. Without consent, the deputy searched for and found Malouf's license, at which point he was released without any charges. Malouf believes he was the victim of racial profiling.
Although it was around 10 p.m. at night, you can clearly see who I am. There was no reason whatsoever to pull me over. And I think it was a ruse to say he heard a loud voice. There was no loud voice. And I believe I was pulled over because I was Black driving an expensive car.
UC Berkeley social psychologist Jack Glaser says stereotyping is a normal human behavior.
There are predominant stereotypes of Blacks and Latinos as being prone to particular kinds of crimes. There are predominant stereotypes of Muslims and Arabs being prone to terrorism and of Latinos being prone to immigration violations. And so these are all things that are in our minds. They're in everybody's minds, whether you endorse them or not.
Glaser says even if officers consciously consider their preconceptions,
it will probably not affect their implicit or non-conscious stereotypes, which are the ones that are operating in the field when they're trying to make a quick judgment about that guy who's moving, who's turning the corner, or who's standing furtively or appears to be, and they're trying to figure out what he's really up to. And so what looks like suspicion to you that's valid might be influenced by racial stereotypes.
Quizon Malouf filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the Alameda County Sheriff's Office.
I want the police to know that when they do make a mistake, they should be accountable for their mistakes.
One of the things he's seeking is police training on race sensitivity. Alameda County Sheriff Greg Ahern says he can't respond to the specific case because it's in litigation.
But in cases where people believe they're stopped because of their skin color, could possibly be their belief. But that doesn't mean that's the reason the deputy or law enforcement professional took that specific action.
Ahern says his deputies already undergo an average of 19 hours of training on cultural awareness. The department has policies against bias-based profiling. It collects statistical data on the race, gender, and age of everyone stopped. And the Internal Affairs Division investigates every complaint. Since 2005, the Sheriff's Office has received 32 complaints based on race, but only found 3 cases involved improper actions by deputies.
Hey, did you really want it there? You got a driver's license?
On a Saturday night, I go for a ride with Alameda County Deputy Ramsey Jackson. As we drive through Hayward, he decides to stop a red Cadillac with an unlatched trunk.
That's kind of weird.
He's got a covered license plate. He's got stuff hanging from his rear. So those are all vehicle code violations. So you stop, you start talking to the person, and then you develop different things. And you realize, oh, okay, gang member. Now, that alone doesn't necessitate us to talk to him. But definitely, if you're in the community and you're participating in the community, you go, well, I wonder what these guys are doing.
Deputy Jackson learns the young Latino driver is on probation. Jackson pats him down and searches the car while his backup frisks the 16-year-old passenger. They find nothing and let them go without issuing a ticket. The stop takes about 20 minutes. As we drive away, we talk about the issue of race in policing.
He's Hispanic, she's Hispanic. I don't have anything to do with why we're stopping him or that we're stopping him. But you realize it's Hayward. A lot of Hispanic people live in Hayward, so I'm going to pull over a lot of Hispanic people just by virtue of the people that are here.
Ron Davis has been wrestling with this problem in East Palo Alto, where he's police chief.
Where I guess it gets confusing for officers is that they look at it from a legal point of view, the person actually had expired registration. But did you realize that the majority of people that you stop for these violations, what we call very high discretionary stops, are of color, and that they're then pretexted to get to searches?
Davis's concerns were shaped in part from an incident he and his wife experienced in 1996 while driving their Mercedes-Benz on an L.A. freeway.
When they looked at the car, their reactions in their face, they then jumped on their motorcycles, pulled behind us and stopped us. And I just felt to them was, why are these two, you know, African-Americans inside this nice car? I felt that it was, you know, everything after that was negative. But I felt like I was profiled, so it stood out for me in that case.
It also prompted Davis to think about his own career as a cop, and he realized he had also engaged in racial profiling.
But I knew that it wasn't based on racism. I knew it wasn't based on malicious intent, that it was probably more based on stereotypes and my own implicit bias.
Davis took over as police chief in 2005. East Palo Alto had the second highest per capita murder rate in California and the fifth highest rate in the U.S. He responded by developing guides on accurate data collection and analysis. And he worked to build trust between police and the community they serve.
One of the things that was very important for me, and I think is very important in departments, is rotating throughout the department and increasing the opportunities for the officers to engage in the community in a non-enforcement capacity.
He also increased cultural competence trainings, organized community forums, and implemented a parole reentry program.
One of the officers who worked it told me that it changed his view with regards to how he thought about parolees, and it clearly changed the view of the parolees that now saw this officer as actually trying to help.
Statistically, his methods worked. The city's recidivism rate dropped from more than 60% to less than 20% within 3 years. By 2011, murders fell almost 50% compared to 2005. And he thinks his officers understand how to avoid stereotyping. This spring, Davis took his experiences both as policeman and activist to Washington to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee about racial profiling.
And even though I'm a police chief with over 27 years experience, I know that when I teach my son Glenn how to drive, I must also teach him what to do when stopped by the police. A mandatory course, by the way, for young men of color in this country.
He also advocated for the passage of the End Racial Profiling Act of 2011, which was introduced by the Senate last year. If passed, a standardized definition of racial profiling would emerge nationally, and law enforcement agencies would have to collect data and provide sensitivity training or risk losing federal funding. Currently, the definition varies from state to state, department to department.
I also fear that without this legislation, we will continue business as usual and only respond to issues when they surface through high-profile tragedies, such as the Oscar Grant case in Oakland and the Trayvon Martin case in Florida.
Attorney Quizon Maloof still feels violated about how he was treated by the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. But one thing he and the sheriff agree on is the need to report these kinds of incidents.
I think what we need to do as a people, no matter what race you are, if you believe the police made a mistake or did something wrong, whether intentionally or not, you must file a complaint with the Office of Citizen Complaint. You must file a complaint with their internal affairs. You must do something about it.
Federal legislation may help standardize policies and enforcement, but social psychologist Jack Glaser says profiling is an issue that is not ever likely to go away.
there's going to be racial profiling as long as there are stereotypes about race and crime and there's law enforcement. And there has been for as long as there have been, and there will be going into the future. It's just a matter of squeezing it down as much as we can through interventions and through awareness.
For Cross Currents, I'm Kyungjin Lee.
Have you witnessed or been a victim of racial profiling? Given all of the stereotypes we have of other people, subconscious or not, do you think it's possible to move beyond racial profiling? You can share your thoughts with us at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106, and we'll try to get your call on the air. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. In that last story, we heard of people getting arrested or harassed by the police, possibly because of the color of their skin. But this happens even without racial profiling. Sometimes a person ends up in prison, even for years, because of what's called a wrongful conviction. The Northern California Innocence Project has helped to exonerate at least 13 people. The average amount of time an exonerated prisoner has spent behind bars is more than 13 years. Mistaken identities, mishandled evidence, and misconduct are a few ways wrongful convictions happen. Every system has flaws, but the stakes are especially high in criminal justice. An error can mean the difference between sending a guilty or innocent person to prison. San Francisco resident Maurice Caldwell was a low-level drug dealer living in Bernal Heights when he found out just how devastating a relatively simple blunder can be. KALW's Julia Lundberg has the story.
Let's go back in time about 20 years. It's the early 90s. Young people are watching MTV, their parents' Twin Peaks. Maurice Caldwell is 22 years old and lives in the Almeny Projects in Bernal Heights, on the same streets where he grew up. He works in an industrial warehouse in Hayward and likes to hang out with his friends.
We went places, did things, go to the movies, go horseback riding, go fishing, go bowling, play ball.
But Caldwell is the first to say he was a troublemaker.
I wasn't a choir boy. I wasn't, you know, no angel. I sold drugs, you know. I did that, you know, time to time.
And from time to time, he'd come in contact with police.
I used to get arrested like two or three times a month, you know. So it was nothing new to me, you know, because I was like, there's nothing, you know. They just want to, you know, question me and let me go.
Until, in the morning hours, one day in September of 1990, when Caldwell was picked up and taken to the county jail at 850 Bryant Street. That day, police accused him of murder.
It was a shock. It was a complete shock. I felt like, oh, y'all tripping. Y'all making a mistake. You know what I'm saying? You really don't know your job if you're trying to accuse me of murder. You're not doing your job.
What did they say?
This is what they said. You had a right to remain silent. You was under arrest. That's what they say.
On June 30 of 1990, on the 900 block of Ellsworth Street in the Almeny Projects, a man named Judy Acosta was murdered outside a car. Police found one woman who witnessed the killing as she stood at her apartment window. When police first questioned her, she told them that the shooters do not live around here, and she didn't know their nicknames. 2 weeks later, police returned with a picture of the woman's neighbor, Maurice Caldwell. According to what was later presented at trial, the woman identified Caldwell as the shooter and said she'd seen him standing under a streetlight when Acosta was shot. Whether the streetlight is even visible from the woman's window became a big question, but not until years later. At the trial, no one questioned her testimony, and Caldwell was disappointed with his lawyer.
I had a so-called lawyer, but he was ineffective, totally. He didn't do nothing to, you know, help me fight my case.
The prosecutor, Al Giannini, was an assistant district attorney in San Francisco at the time. He says it's not surprising the witness changed her story, nor did he hide that fact at trial.
I'd like to remind you the jury actually heard those tapes. And I think they accepted the fact that she was saying a couple of different things. I think it's just the sort of apparent inconsistency that happens when people describe things. But if you talk to them a little bit, they clear it up, and it's clear that they mean the same thing.
Giannini believes Mary Cobbs, the witness, was telling the truth.
It is my personal opinion that Mary Cobb was an entirely credible witness, and certainly the jury accepted it, and she was very compelling.
Caldwell's trial for first-degree murder proceeded quickly. What would usually be a year's worth of preparation was condensed into 6 months.
They didn't take their time and do the work that needed to be done, you know, in order to show that it's an innocent man incarcerated. You know, they just wanted to go on my character and look at bad at character, and that's all what was going to lead to the conviction. And that's what happened. When they were saying guilty, I thought they were saying not guilty. You know, I really thought justice prevailed, and then I looked at my lawyer and my family and them, and they were shaking their head like, it didn't dawn on me they were saying guilty.
2 weeks after the trial ended, the 23-year-old Maurice Caldwell was locked up at San Quentin State Prison.
I had 27 years to life. When they say to life, that can mean your entire life. From when they first put the handcuff on me, I was thinking of a way to get up out of this. You know, what can I say? What can I do?
And unlike other inmates who hung out in the yard, made acquaintances, and started to build a life for themselves in prison, Caldwell became a self-styled student of the law.
Because the comfortability in prison, or relaxed in prison, that means, you know, you're doing everything in there. You want to be a part of everything. You know, they got games, sports. You know, they got bingo night. You're a part of all that. They got job, trades. They got work programs. I didn't want none of that. You know, all I wanted to do was deal with the law.
Caldwell wrote letters to attorneys all over the country, always saying the same thing.
I was writing to all these places to get, you know, somebody to hear me, that I'm in prison for a crime I didn't do, and it's going many days, years, you know, but I continue.
And after 17 years in prison, he finally got an answer from Paige Koenig, a lawyer with the California Innocence Project.
I got a box of files on his case in January of 2008.
Koenig went through thousands of pages of trial transcripts and scrutinized all the facts surrounding the one witness who testified.
She went from saying, they don't live around here and I don't know their nicknames, to it's Tuan who lived next door to me. I immediately was like, all right, this is, you know, this is clearly a problem.
So Koenig had a list of dozens of people who had lived in the area and might have seen something. She searched for them one by one and eventually found one person who had been out there that night almost 20 years earlier and who could help her find two other witnesses.
For both of them, it was the first time they'd ever seen anyone shot and killed, so this stood out as something in their minds, and both of them told us who the two real shooters were.
Koenig says, unlike the police, she was careful about influencing the witnesses' memories.
I interviewed them separately. They hadn't spoken to each other. None of them have spoken to Maurice or the guy who confessed, who's now in prison for another murder. I kept thinking that at some point someone was going to care about who really did this, you know, who really killed this guy. And it was just like they didn't care at all.
The whole process of overturning Caldwell's conviction took more than 3 years.
And Maurice's mom was sick during a lot of this time. And he was really, really patient throughout everything. But he would tell me sometimes, you know, I'd just like to be able to get out in time to take care of my mom.
While Caldwell's mother got sicker and sicker, the legal system sputtered and stalled.
And she died during the year of delays of the DA's office.
Caldwell did get out. A judge found that Caldwell's defense attorney had been incompetent and overturned his conviction. While Caldwell and Koenig believe justice has been served, Giannini's disappointed with the outcome.
These things, they happen. It's unfortunate that you can have a case that goes all the way through the system, and the police did nothing wrong, the prosecution did nothing wrong, the jurors did nothing wrong, and the witnesses all told the truth. And yet, because of something that has, you know, nothing to do with guilt or innocence, a murder conviction is overturned years and years after the fact when it can't be retried. It's just something that happens. We all have to live with it.
On March 28, 2011, Caldwell walked out of custody and met up with his sister and his lawyers. His first destination, McDonald's. On a cold November day, we're parked in Maurice Caldwell's blue Corolla. Now he lives in the East Bay and hardly ever comes back to San Francisco since he got out of prison nearly a year ago.
March 28, 2011. Yep, that's my day. Me walking out of 850 Bryan with my jail paperwork and some county clothes that they gave me with a big old smile on my face. That's what that is.
How would you like it to have been?
Most of all, me hugging my mom and my grandmother. That's the most thing I would have wanted out of anything in life, to be able to hug my mother and my grandmother and tell her I told you. For them to be able to see me come home now and know that everything I was telling them, that would mean more to me than anything. You know, and I don't got that.
Caldwell is not a rarity. He's just one of hundreds of former inmates whose conviction have been overturned after spending years in prison. He's hoping to sue the state and get compensation for the time he served. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Lundberg for Cross Currents. You can hear all of our stories at klw.org. You can also post comments on our Facebook page. We're KLW News. Do you think mistakes in the criminal justice system are preventable or inevitable? You can let us know at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Last week, the California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco's Golden Gate Park launched a major new exhibit called Earthquake. It's got a walkthrough model of the Earth, an interactive space to teach earthquake preparedness, and even live ostriches. Apparently, there's a connection. There's also an earthquake simulator resembling an old Victorian home, bringing us right back to the big one in 1906. Very few people are alive today who witnessed that earthquake 106 years ago. But even if they are still here, they were often too young then or too old now to remember. But there are many recordings from the 1950s and 60s that still exist, and they've been collected by the Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. Sam Redman, a newly minted PhD from the office, joined KALW's Stephen Short to talk about these stories preserved from one of the most significant events to touch our region. We'll kick off the conversation by hearing the voice of Kathleen Norris, who was 25 years old at the time of the Great Quake. Her voice was recorded half a century ago.
In the first place, most people have the feeling, especially when they've watched the movies about earthquakes, that things racket and roll as if you were crossing the channel on the 3rd of February. As a matter of fact, it's a rather quiet performance. There's a deep, earthy sound that's subterranean, very disturbing, but it's just a matter of a gentle clicking and clacking and rattling, but it's everywhere. Every picture on the wall is going tack, tack, tack.
That was Kathleen Norris talking about the 1906 earthquake. We'll hear about her soon, but did you notice the excellent sound quality here? Sam Redman, that interview was recorded in 1960, but it sounds as if it could have been recorded earlier today. We've all heard scratchy old recordings from the 60s and earlier, so why does this one sound so good?
This one is part of a recent effort to revisit some of our archives and digitize and bring into the 21st century some of our old recordings. And our office was founded in the 1950s, and since then, we've gone through, as you might imagine, all sorts of different iterations of recording technologies. So we have to revisit some of these archives and modernize them and make them available through modern technologies. And now to put them on the web, it's enormously powerful as a resource.
Well, the 1906 earthquake has been studied to death by now, hasn't it? I mean, what's the point of hearing these things?
So we have these documents that can tell us about how the city's changed in terms of old films and photographs and images and maps. But those things, they don't really tell us what it was like to experience on a first-hand account of what it was like to experience life during that time. It doesn't tell us about what the actual lived experience was for the people who went through the events in April 1906.
Well, somebody who does tell us about that is Kathleen Norris, so we should hear another clip from her. But first, I'd like to ask you a couple of things. First, who was she? And second, why does she sound like Queen Victoria?
That's a great question. Kathleen Norris was an author. She later becomes an author. And this interview was recorded shortly after our office was founded. This interview is recorded in 1960, but it's about her recollections of what life was like for her when she was a 25-year-old young woman living in Mill Valley in 1906. And you can hear in her voice and her tone, you mentioned, you asked why she sounds like Queen Victoria. Her mode of speaking, her tone, her pace, her inflections are all influenced by the people she's around. And she's the circles that her family was in, the networks that she was in, were high society circles in San Francisco. So you hear a tone and inflection. And that, to me, is why, again, we have this massive archive at the Regional Oral History Office. And many of these things have been transcribed. But hearing the actual voice is really powerful, and it helps us reach to the past in a way that I don't think reading on a transcript can quite capture in the same way.
But we all rushed out onto the porch, and we all looked at each other aghast, and we said, "What is this? It must be an earthquake." And, of course, the silence of the morning was so exquisite. It was April, and of course it was lilacs, and it was roses, and it was redwoods over there. Beautiful, glorious morning, just sunrise. And then we could hear the voices of other people who had run out of their houses. And you could hear up and down the roads, "Earthquake, it's an earthquake. Oh, God help us, it's an earthquake."
What's interesting to me is that she articulates in her recollections her perceived realities and then also what it felt like. She says, "I know that the earthquake only lasted a moment, but it felt like it lasted 5 minutes." And then she follows that up by saying, "But of course, it changed our world forever." So these are sort of things that you can interview someone on the ground, but there's also a benefit to having that sort of length of time where people can reflect on the events that happened in their lives and think about it in sorts of different ways.
Well, you brought this other clip of her as she describes coming into San Francisco. So let's hear that.
"And so we walked up Van Ness on this glorious, beautiful spring morning, and we saw our city die. It was something to see. The great, heavy, slow rolls of smoke that were joining hands as they went up, and the people, very cheerful, very philosophical. There was no screaming."
That was author Kathleen Norris remembering the 1906 earthquake and fire in a newly digitized copy of an interview in the holdings of the Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. Sam Redmond of that office is with us today. I'm Stephen Short. Sam, as we said, there was a great period of time that passed between the actual quake and her recollection here, but I've heard more emotional accounts of somebody losing a pet.
That's it's an interesting interesting way to phrase it. I think one of the really important things of having these oral histories is that it does really add a human voice to the past. And a letter or a diary does a similar sort of thing that I think a photograph or a film might not accomplish. It might not really give us that human voice to upend some of our assumptions. I would think that that an account, a firsthand account of the San Francisco earthquake, might sound and feel a bit different than how Kathleen Norris remembers it. But that's why it's important to collect as many oral histories as we can and preserve these accounts for future generations of historians, and then also students and members of the public to look at and re-examine and question some of their own assumptions.
Well, now, speaking of students and historians having access to this and being able to hear this firsthand material, that's going to be open access, I think, right?
That's right. And open access is something that's very important for our office, something we strive to accomplish. And previously, we've been able to make as many transcripts available as possible. But like we've talked about today, there's something in hearing the actual voice, the actual sound recording. And previously, these recordings would be available to students and researchers, but it meant coming onto campus and listening to them in our reading room, which is gorgeous and is a very inviting warm space. But it also means now when we can digitize and bring things to the web, that we can open that up for historians and students who weren't previously able to come and listen to these. Now they can hear these voices that have previously been in our archive.
Sam Redman works with the Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. He spoke with KALW's Stephen Short. You can learn more about Berkeley's collection of stories and check out the latest Cal Academy exhibit at our website. It's kalw.org. That's also where you can hear all of our stories and subscribe to our podcast. And now it's time for more stories from San Francisco's StoryCorps. Phyllis Lyon was the founder of the first lesbian rights organization in the United States, Daughters of Bilitis, in 1955. You may recall her name as she and her wife Del Martin were the first same-sex couple to be married under the authority of Gavin Newsom when he became mayor in 2004. Phyllis recounts her life experiences, such as connecting with Del Martin, navigating anti-gay laws in San Francisco in the 1950s, her book Lesbian, Woman, and shifting her perspective on marriage at the StoryCorps booth in San Francisco, where she spoke with Margie Adams.
The different ways that lesbians come out, some of us know from very early age that we love other women, that we're drawn to girls, all of that. And some of us have no idea that that's true until we meet someone in particular.
That's about the way it was for me. I certainly had no idea. When I was in school many, many, many years ago, they weren't teaching anything about sexuality. Or I don't even know if they ever mentioned the word. Goodness gracious. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s, sort of, that I met the woman that I spent the rest of my life with, and that was Del Martin. We got together in 1953 on Valentine's Day. It was Del's idea. We'll never forget our anniversary, she said. And we never did. We discovered also that there were a lot of laws that were anti-gay and a lot of things that needed to be done, and that there were more things to do than just party. We decided we'd put out a newsletter, and then we decided that we would have a series of lectures about how it was okay to be lesbian or gay. We couldn't advertise. None of the papers in town at that time, the Chronicle, the Examiner, the whatever, would take any kind of an ad that had homosexuality in it. They'd write letters about people getting arrested.
So desperate, as so many of us were, to make contact with other lesbians, but also terrified because it was illegal.
We got enough membership, and the latter, which we had not expected to turn into a magazine, had turned into a magazine. I was the first editor of the latter. One friend who was in New York, she said, every month when it came, all these other lesbians in the city descended on her house because she wouldn't let them take it out of her house. It began to grow after that. We rented the Whitcomb Hotel, a place to have a conference, and all of a sudden we saw these two guys that were from the sex detail and the police department. We knew them because we'd talked to them before.
And these are the same kind of guys that'd be rousting women in the lesbian bars, doing gay raids.
Yeah, and so what they said their problem was that they wanted to make sure that no women were here dressed like men.
What was the issue of women dressing like men?
It was illegal to wear the clothes of the opposite sex. And in those days, women did not go downtown in San Francisco without having on heels and gloves and hats and all dressed up. And homosexuals weren't supposed to get together. Well, we had not been fans of getting married. We were with the feminist movement, and the feminist movement was anti-marriage. So, you know, they felt that men took a hell of an advantage over their wives, and which I think was true, and women didn't really have a way to fight back, some women anyway. So we hadn't even given that a thought, but when Kate Kendall from the National Center for Lesbian Rights called us, it was in 2004, and she said, how would you like to get married? And we said, huh? You know what? But, well, the mayor wants to arrange for gay marriages. We think that it would be you and Dale should be the first ones to get married. And so we talked about it and said, I guess we could do that, you know. And the whole idea was that if we could start something and that gay people could get married, then lesbians weren't going to do the same thing men and women did. So what the hell? But there are a lot of advantages to being married. We're much closer to the idea that women are totally equal to men. And I think we're a lot closer to that, although I don't think we've actually reached it totally.
Phyllis and Dell were married again in 2008 after the state reissued licenses. Here's a clip of that ceremony being officiated by San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom.
You've always been destined to enjoy this blessed and extraordinary day. It is my extraordinary honor to pronounce you spouses for life.
Del Martin passed away shortly after, in August of 2008. Margie Adam interviewed her role model Phyllis Lyon at the San Francisco StoryCorps booth in the Contemporary Jewish Museum. Her interview was facilitated by Sarah Geis and edited by KALW's Lisa Ratner. To learn more about how you can participate in StoryCorps, go to our website, kalw.org. You've been listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. The team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Artyom's Kunachovs, Audrey Dilling, Emily Gaddick, Holly J. McDeed, Chris Hoff, Zoe Bresny, Mary Reese, Lupe Hernandez, Buffy Almandares, Judy Silber, Lisa Ratner, Erica Mu, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, Martina Castro is our managing editor, Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also, thanks to you, we are listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.